You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
My name is Richard Reeves. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings in Economic Studies and co-director of the Center on Children and Families. And it's my job simply to welcome you to this event today on race, class, and culture in America. As well as those of you in the room, I'd like to welcome the, I think, approximately 1,000 or so people who are watching us live. Thank you for joining us. You are every bit as valuable to us as the people in the room. That's not true, of course. They actually came, but still. 50% of you are in your pajamas, but that's okay. Needless to say, we are podcasting, webcasting, tweeting, Facebooking, Instagramming, everything, social media. Please, if you use any or all of those platforms, share using the hashtag RaceInAmerica. Usually at events like this, the introducer will say something like, our speakers need no introduction, and then launch into a very long introduction of our speakers. I'm not going to do that today. My job essentially is to say hello and welcome and then get out of the way. So I'll introduce the three people you're going to be hearing from over the course of this afternoon's event. First, and on your right, William Julius Wilson, who is currently the Lewis P. and Linda L. Geiser University Professor at Harvard University, one of the leading sociologists of race and inequality in recent scholarship. Secondly, and on your left as you look at the stage, is J.D. Vance. He is the author of the best-selling book Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. And moderating the discussion and host of today's events is our relatively new colleague at Brookings, Camille Bousset. Camille is a senior fellow in governance studies here at Brookings, and she is the director of a new initiative at Brookings, the Race, Place, and Inclusion Initiative, and she is going to be in charge of events from here on forth. So, Camille, over to you, and welcome to our guests.
Thanks, Richard. I'm indebted to Richard, who had the foresight to invite Bill and JD for this conversation well before I arrived at Brookings. And also, I want to thank Richard for his graciousness in inviting me to moderate this discussion as well. I also would like to warmly welcome Bill and JD here to Brookings and welcome our audiences both here at Brookings and those who are following us by webcast and otherwise. Bill and JD, it's truly a pleasure to have you both here. Before we get started, I just wanted to acknowledge that today is a very difficult day for the 800,000 American Dreamers who are affected by DACA. Today we're going to be covering some very timely and sensitive topics. Topics that explore who we are as Americans and why we are still struggling with entrenched poverty, increasing inequality, and the tragic waste of significant human potential some 30 years after Bill Wilson first published his watershed book, The Truly Disadvantaged. As we begin this conversation, I want our audience to understand the personal experiences you both bring to your perspectives on poor Americans. Bill and JD, I'd like each of you to share with us a personal experience from your childhood that had a profound impact on you and your perspectives on poverty. And Bill, I'm going to ask you to go first.
Oh, thank you. So, in answer to that challenging question, I should point out, first of all, that Hillbilly Elegy is a very important book, and it also resonated with me in a very personal way, because I also experienced the problems of rural poverty. I grew up in a small town in western Pennsylvania. My father was a coal miner, worked in this coal mines of western Pennsylvania, and occasionally he worked in steel mills in western Pennsylvania. He died at the age of 39 with lung disease, left my mother with six kids, and I was the oldest at 12 years of age. My father had a 10th grade education. My mother had a 10th grade education. My mother, who lived to the ripe old age of 94, raised us by cleaning house occasionally. Initially, we were on relief. We call it welfare now. She got off welfare and supported us by cleaning house. And what I distinctly remember about growing up in rural poverty is hunger. You know, I reviewed a book in the New York Times. Kathy Eden and Luke Schaefer's book, $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. That book really captured my experiences. And I distinctly remember the times when we went hungry because my mother did not have any money, and it was during the winter time, and sometimes she had to use her own creativity in coming up with work because coming up with food because she couldn't draw from the garden. Now, given my family background, black person, black family in rural poverty, as one of my colleagues at Harvard told me, the odds that I would end up at Harvard as a university professor in capital U on university are very nearly zero. And like JD, I'm an outlier in Malcolm Gladwell's sense, in his book Outlier, The Study of Success. We are both outliers. But it's interesting that J.D. never talks about pulling himself up by his own bootstraps. And that's something that I reject. I don't refer to myself that way. Because both J.D. and I were in the right places at the right times. And we had significant individuals who were there to rescue us from poverty and enabled us to escape. We are the outliers, being the right place, the right time. And when I think about your question, that's one thing I think about. How lucky I was that I had some significant individuals who helped me escape poverty.
Thank you, Bill. J.D.?
Well, first, thanks, Camille. Thanks, Richard, for hosting this. It's really wonderful to be here, and I'm a bit of a fanboy of William Julius Wilson as I write in Hillbilly Elegy, so it was really exciting to be able to get him to sign this book. I think that the story that stands out to me is, and there's a bit of a background here, which is that, you know, I was 6 or 7 years old. I remember my mom, who was trying to get some sort of certification to become a nurse. And eventually, after a couple of years, I remember being old enough that she sort of had to test how to draw blood on me, and that was sort of something I volunteered for because I thought it was really cool because I was a weird kid. And I remember that eventually she made it, and she was able to work as a nurse for a couple of years, and this just so happened to overlap with a period where she was married to a truck driver, a guy who hadn't graduated from high school but was able to drive a truck. And so if you think about those two incomes together, there was this period where I felt like we had genuinely made it, where we had this financial stability that was pretty remarkable given the history of my family. And I think the way that it fell apart so quickly, and the way that even in the midst of that financial security, life was so chaotic and so unstable, and eventually when that very precarious sort of middle class lifestyle fell apart economically, all of the instability that existed in our home sort of came crashing down upon us. And so it felt like after this 2-year period, we were in an even worse situation than we were going into it. And I think, you know, one of the things that taught me, and one of the, I think, the ways that it influenced the way that I think about poverty and inequality and upward mobility, is that the problems that a lot of poor families face aren't purely income related, that some of the lessons that you learn, some of the things that you acquire when you are really struggling, they follow you even when you're not struggling in a purely material sense. And then when that struggle in a material sense returns, it can make all of those non-material things that much worse off. And I think that that way of understanding these problems has really influenced the way that I think about a lot of the problems that I write about in the book.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you both very much. You know, I want to talk a little bit about the place of poverty in the American narrative. And that narrative is complicated. In a recent survey conducted by the American Enterprise Institute in the Los Angeles Times, white Americans linked poverty with laziness and lack of ambition. And when we think of the welfare reform debates from the 1990s, there were very ungenerous terms used to describe the poor. The National Opinion Research Center also released a survey that shows that over the last two decades, there has never been such a bigger divide between white Republicans and white Democrats when it comes to the views of the intelligence and work ethic of African Americans. More generally, Americans think of poverty as an individual failure, and its opposite, financial success, is the result of hard work and smarts. I want each of you to reflect on these narratives of poverty and give us your perspectives. Bill, I'm going to start with you.
Okay. A very challenging question, and I'm going to try to answer it by also pointing out some differences that I have with JD. It's really kind of a matter of emphasis, not that we differ, just a matter of emphasis. First of all, we both agree that too many liberal social scientists focus on social structure and ignore cultural conditions. You know, they talk about poverty, joblessness, and discrimination, but they also don't talk about some of the cultural conditions that grow out of these situations, that in response to these situations. Too many conservatives focus on cultural forces and ignore structural factors. Now, J.D. has makes the same point in Hillbilly Elegy, and you also have made in some made the same point in some subsequent interviews talking about the book. Now, where we disagree, and this relates back to your question, Camille, is in the interpretation of these cultural factors. Now, J.D. Places a lot of emphasis on agency, that people, in even in the most impoverished circumstances, have choices that can either improve or exacerbate their situation, their predicaments. Now, I also think that agency is important and should not be ignored, even in situations where individuals confront overwhelming structural impediments. But what J.D., and I'd like to get your response to this, J.D., what you don't make explicit or emphasize enough from my point of view is that agency is also constrained by these structural factors. Even among people who, you know, make positive choices to improve their lives, there's still constraints. And I maintain that the part of your book where you're talking about agency really cries out for a deeper interrogation, a deeper interrogation of how personal agency is expanded or inhibited by the circumstances that the poor or working classes confront, including, you know, their interactions in families, social networks, and institutions in these distressed distressed communities. In other words, what I'm trying to suggest is that personal agency is recursively associated with the structural forces within which it operates. And, you know, here, you know, it's sort of insightful to talk about intermediaries and insightful to talk about people who aid, who help you in making choices, you know, and you do that well in the book. But here's the point. You know, given the American belief system on poverty and welfare, in which Americans, as you point out, Camille, place far greater emphasis on personal shortcomings as opposed to structural barriers, and especially when they're talking about the behavior of African Americans, I believe that explanations that focus here, don't get me wrong, you don't even talk about African Americans in this sense. I'm talking about people out there in the general public. Given this focus on personal shortcomings as opposed to structural barriers in accounting for outcomes, I believe that explanations that focus on agency are likely to overshadow explanations that focus on structural impediments. When people read a book, if they're not that sophisticated, the takeaway will be those personal factors. And, you know, I would have liked to have seen you sort of try to put things in context. You know, you talk about the constraints that people have. Now, this relates to the second point I want to make. In addition to feeling that they have little control over themselves, that is, lack of agency, you point out that the individuals in these hillbilly communities tend to blame themselves. I mean, I'm sorry, blame everyone but themselves. And the term you use to explain this phenomenon is cognitive dissonance, when our beliefs are not consistent with our behaviors. Now, I agree that many people often do tend to blame themselves, blame others and not themselves. But I think that when we talk about cognitive dissonance, we also have to recognize that individuals in these communities do indeed have some complaints, some justifiable complaints, including complaints about industries that have pulled up stakes and relocated to cheaper labor areas overseas, and in the process have devastated communities like Middletown, Ohio, including complaints about automation replacing the jobs of cashiers and parking lot attendants, including the complaints that government and corporate actions have undermined unions and therefore led to a decrease in the wages of workers in Middletown. I'm sorry, I've gone on too far. I'll let you respond.
That was interesting. Now, here's your chance.
Sure. Well, so I'll make two broad points. One, hopefully, more responsive to your initial question. And the second, more responsive to Bill's concerns. So the first, this point about culture, which is a really, really difficult and amorphous concept to define. And one of the things that I was trying to do with Hillbilly Elegy is try to, in some ways, draw the discussion away from this structure versus personal responsibility narrative and convince us to look at culture as a third and, I think, very important variable. Because, you know, I often think that the way that conservatives, and I'm a conservative, talk about culture is in some ways an excuse to end a conversation instead of starting a much more important conversation. It's look at their bad culture, look at their deficient culture, we can't do anything to help them, instead of trying to understand culture as this much bigger social and institutional force that really is important, that some cases can come from problems related to poverty, in some cases can come from a host of different factors that are difficult to understand. So, you know, here's what I mean by that. So one of the most important, I think, cultural problems that I talk about is the prevalence of family instability and family trauma in some of the communities that I write about. And I take it as a given that that trauma and that instability is really bad, that it has really negative downstream effects on whether children are able to get an education, whether they're able to enter the workforce, whether they're able to raise and maintain successful families themselves. Now, I think it's tempting to sort of look at the problems of family instability in families like mine and say there's a structural problem. If only people had access to better economic opportunities, they wouldn't have this problem. I think that's partially true, but also consequently partially false. I think there's a tendency on the right to look at that and say these parents need to take better care of their families and of their children, and unless they do it, there's nothing that we can do. And I think, again, that is maybe partially true, but it's also very significantly false. And what I'm trying to point to in this concept of culture is we know that when children grow up in very unstable families, that it has important cognitive effects. We know that it has important psychological effects. And unless we understand the problem of family instability and trauma, not just as a structural problem or a problem of personal responsibility, but as a long-term problem, in some cases inherited from multiple generations back, then we're not going to be able to appreciate what's really going on in some of these families and why family instability and trauma is so durable and so difficult to actually solve. And so I tend to think of culture as, in some ways, this way to sum all of the things that are neither structural nor individual. What is it that's going on in people's environments, good and bad, that make it difficult for them to climb out of poverty? What are the things that they inherit, not just from their own families, but from multiple generations back, behaviors, expectations, environmental attitudes that make it really hard for them to succeed and do well? That's the concept of culture that I think is most important, and also, frankly, that I think is missing a little bit from our political conversation when we talk about these questions of poverty. We're really comfortable talking about personal responsibility. We're really comfortable talking about structural problems. We don't often talk about culture in this way that I'm trying to talk about it in Hillbilly Elegy.
Can I Sure. No, go ahead, J.D.
No,
sorry. No. Look, I agree. It's a matter of emphasis.
Sure.
That's all I'm saying. Right. Now, and let me also point out, here's where we really do agree, and that we both agree that there are cultural practices within families and so on and in communities that reinforce problems created by the structural barriers.
Yep.
Reinforce factors, behaviors that perpetuate poverty and disadvantage. So this we agree. And you know, too often liberals ignore the role of these cultural forces in perpetuating or reinforcing conditions associated with poverty or concentrated poverty.
Absolutely. So the second point that I wanted to make, and I'll try to be brief, is this question of agency and whether I overemphasize the role of agency. And I think that, you know, for me, this is a really tough line to toe, because I'm sort of writing about these problems, you know, having in my personal memory, I'm not that far removed from a lot of them. I know that myself, one of the biggest problems that I faced was that I really did start to give up on myself early in high school, and I think that's a really significant problem. At the same time, I understand and recognize the problem that Bill mentions, which is that we have this tendency to sort of overemphasize personal agency and to, you know, proverbially blame the victim for a lot of these problems. And so what I was trying to do with this discussion of personal agency in the book, and I may have failed, but this is the effort, this is what I'm really trying to accomplish, is that the first instance, I do think that it's important, you know, for kids like me in circumstances like mine to pick up the book and to have at least some reinforcement of the agency that they have. I do think that's a significant problem from the perspective of kids who grew up in communities like mine. The second thing that I'm trying to do is talk about personal agency, not just from the perspective of individual poor people, but from the entire community that surrounds them. So one of the things that I talk about is, as religious communities in these areas, do they have the, as I say in the book, toughness to build churches that encourage more social engagement as opposed to more social disaffection? I think that's a question of personal agency, not from the perspective of the impoverished kid, but from a religious leader and community leaders that exist in their neighborhood. So I think that sense of personal agency is really important. One of the worries that I have is that when we talk about the problems of impoverished kids, and this is especially true among sort of my generation, so this is the on the tail end of the millennials here, is that we tend to think about helping people, 10 million people at a time, at a very superficial level. And one of the calls to action that I make in the book with this by pointing out to personal agency is the idea that it can be really impactful to make a difference in 10 lives at a very deep level, at the community level. And I think that's sometimes missing from these conversations. And then the final point that I'll make is that there's a difference between recognizing the importance of personal agency and, ignoring the role of structural factors in some of these problems, right? So the example that I use to highlight this in the book is this question of addiction. So there's some interesting research that suggests that people who believe inherently that their addiction is a disease show slightly less proclivity to actually fight that addiction and overcome that addiction. So that creates sort of a catch-22, because we know there are biological components to addiction. We know that there are these sort of structural, non-personal decision-making drivers of addiction. And yet, if you totally buy in to the non-individual choice explanation for addiction, you show less of a proclivity to fight it. And so I think that there is this really tough undercurrent to some of our discussions on these issues, where as a society, we want to simultaneously recognize the barriers that people face, but also encourage them not to play a terrible hand in a terrible way. And that's what I'm trying to do with this discussion of personal agency. The final point that I'll make on that is that the person who towed that line better than anyone I've ever known was my grandma, my mamaw, who I think is in some ways the hero of the book. She always told me, look, JD, life is unfair for us, but don't be like those people who think the deck is hopelessly stacked against them. I think that's a sentiment that you hear far too infrequently among America's elites, this simultaneous recognition that life is unfair for a lot of poor Americans, but that we still have to emphasize the role of individual agency in spite of that unfairness. And I think that's, again, a difficult balancing act. I may not have struck that balancing act perfectly in the book, but that was the intention.
Thank you.
So, Camille, do you mind if I follow up? Because, I mean, this is an interesting conversation, and you just raised a point there about optimism, which I think is very, very important. Because, you know, one point that resonated with me in your book is that you pointed out, I think it was 2010, 2011. By the way, I read your book twice, you know, so that's why I remember these things. And I enjoyed it both times. I mean, it's a great book. You pointed out that in 2010 or 2011, you were overwhelmingly hopeful about the future. And that for the first time in your life, you felt like an outsider in Middletown, Ohio. And what made you feel like an alien, as you put it, was your optimism. And I think that that's the key. People who have some hope for the future behave differently. And I think that if there were some way to generate hope and optimism among people in Appalachia, or among the Appalachian transplants, you would see a change in their behavior. And this argument applies not only to those in distressed rural communities, but also distressed urban communities. And I think immediately of the Harlem Children's Zone. The kids who are lucky enough to be a part of I assume all of you know about the Harlem Children's Zone. The kids who are lucky enough to be part of the Harlem Children's Zone are kids who develop in the process hopeful feeling, a feeling that they have a future, and therefore they're not going to do anything to jeopardize that future. You became optimistic. What factors led you to develop that optimism?
Yeah, that's a good question. I might ask you the same question after I'm done answering. But
right,
you know, I mean, the first thing is definitely, you know, going back to my grandma. I think that if anybody had reason for pessimism and cynicism about the future, it was her. It's sort of difficult to imagine a woman who had lived a more difficult life. And yet Mamaw had this constant optimism about the future, this sense that we had to do better because that was just the way that was the way that America worked. I mean, I think that she was this woman who had this deep and abiding faith in the American dream in a way that's obviously disappearing. And in fact, as I write about in the book, was I started to see disappearing even, you know, when I was a young kid in my early 20s. So I think that my grandma was a huge part of that. I also think that the Marine Corps was a really huge part of that, and this is sort of a transformational experience that I write about in the book. You know, the military is this really remarkable institution. It brings people from diverse backgrounds together, gets them on the same team, gets them marching proverbially and literally towards the same goal. And for a kid who'd grown up in a community that was starting to lose faith in that American dream, I think that the military was a really useful way to, as I say in the book, teach a certain amount of willfulness as opposed to despair and hopelessness. So I think that was a really critical piece of it. But at some level, I think it's in some cases impossible to reconstruct that in the past, right? I knew that I was a really hopeless and in some cases detached kid early in high school. I knew that by 2010 I was feeling really optimistic about the future. And I do sometimes wonder how easy it is to reconstruct what took me from point A to point B. But that's those two factors are my best guess.
Did you want to answer his question?
Well, yeah, my mother kept, you know, even in extreme poverty, my mother kept telling me, you're going to college. And my Aunt Janice also reinforced this. My Aunt Janice was the first person in my extended family who got a college education. And I used to go to New York to visit her during the summer months. And I said, you know, I want to be like Aunt Janice, you know.
Sure.
Key people in our lives.
Absolutely.
We are the outliers, J.D.
Yep.
And Malcolm Gladwell since.
So thank you both for that interchange. I think that was incredibly interesting and very illuminating. I want to go back to something you mentioned, J.D., which is this question of culture. And, you know, Bill, I know that the term culture of poverty has a very divisive history and still conjures up very vitriolic debates today. But Bill, you have, over an extraordinary career, created meaningful distinctions about poverty and within that sort of that jargon of poverty. And you've also situated jobless poverty in particular within changes in the economy. Could you tell us what the experiential differences are between jobless poverty and the employed poor?
Well, you really see this when you look at neighborhoods. Neighborhoods in which the overwhelming majority of the population is poor but employed is entirely different from neighborhoods in which people are poor but jobless. Jobless neighborhoods trigger all kinds of problems. Crime, drug addiction, gang behavior, violence. And one of the things that I focused on when I wrote my book, When Work Disappears, is what happens to inner city neighborhoods that experience increasing levels of joblessness. And we did some research in Chicago, and it was really, you know, sad sort of talking to some of the mothers who were just fearful about allowing their children to go outside because the neighborhood was so incredibly dangerous. And I remember talking with one woman, she says, who was obese, and she says, you know, I went to the doctor, he said that I should go out and exercise. Can you imagine jogging in this neighborhood? You know, because the joblessness had created problems among young people who were trying to make ends meet, and they were involved in crime and drugs and so on. So I would say that if you want to focus on improving neighborhoods, the first thing that I would do would try to increase or enhance employment opportunities.
Great, thank you.
I have another story. It just reminds me. I was talking with a young mother, actually, she's young now from my point of view, in the middle 30s. And her son had just been shot in the neighborhood, killed. Stray bullet from a gang fight. She said her son was not a member of the gang. That's one of the reasons why she was so fearful, so concerned about keeping her children indoors. And she said, you know, Mr. Wilson, no one cared that my son died. His death was not reported in any of the newspapers, wasn't reported in the radio, TV. No one cared, Mr. Wilson, that my son died. And I just keep thinking about these families who live in these dangerous, jobless neighborhoods and what they have to endure.
Thank you. Now, one of the themes that comes out clearly from your work, Bill, and from your book, J.D., is the erosion of social networks and social capital. J.D., your book is really an extended love letter to your grandparents who raised you. Can you tell us a little about how the social connections that they had were important to the resilience they showed as parents, as your parents?
Sure. So, you know, my grandparents lived in, I think grew up in a middle town that had much more robust communities than the one that, the town that I grew up in. And so a lot of the relationships they developed, you know, my grandfather was a 35-year union welder at Armco, later AK Steel. My grandmother was a little bit more socially isolated than my grandfather, but still had built up a network of friends over that time. And, you know, going back to Bill's point about having diverse networks of people who actually give you a sense of what's possible and what's out there, that was really, really powerful for me, right? So, you know, of my grandparents' three kids, one obviously is my mom, but my uncle and aunt were doing pretty well when I was a young kid. And so that gave me this sense of what's out there, what's possible. That's really powerful. My grandfather had a number of friends, you know, most of whom were working class like him, but some of whom, you know, owned local businesses or owned local stores, a mechanic shop, things like that. So that also gave me this sense of what was possible. And, I think ultimately, though, I went to the Marine Corps and then off to college. I also think that, you know, the obvious implication is that some of those social networks and connections would have had really powerful economic benefits if I had eventually tried to rely on them. I think that what was so wonderful about my grandparents' social networks is that they were intact enough for me to still have relied upon them. You know, on the other hand, you know, one thing I really worried about, and one thing that I increasingly worried about as I actually did research for the book, is this idea of faith and religion not just as something that people believe in, but as an actual positive institutional and social role player in their lives. And one of the things you do see, and this is something that Charles Murray has written about, is that you see the institutions of faith declining in some of these lower income communities faster than you do in middle and upper income communities. Now, I don't think you have to be a person of faith to think that that's worrisome. I think you can just read a paper, you know, by Jonathan Gruber that talks about all of these really positive social impacts of being a regular participatory church member. And so, you know, I think I was lucky in that sense, but a lot of folks, and when I look at the community right now, it worries me a little bit that you don't see these robust social institutions in the same way that you did certainly 30, 40 years ago, and even when I was growing up in Middletown. The last point that I'll make about that is that we're in, you know, sort of these trends often take a half a century or more to really reveal themselves. And I do sometimes see signs of resilience in some of these communities that I sort of didn't fully anticipate and didn't expect when the book was published. So one of the things I've started to realize, for example, is that when we talk about the decline of institutional faith, even though I continue to worry about that, one of the institutions that's actually picked up the slack are groups like Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous that almost have this faith effect. It brings people together. There's even a sort of liturgical element to some of these meetings that I find really, really fascinating and interesting. So people try to find and replace community when it's lost, but you know, clearly they haven't, at least as of yet, replaced it even remotely to the degree that it has been lost, which is why I think you see some of the issues that we do.
Right, thank you. Bill, I know you have something to say on that, but I wanted to kind of position the question slightly differently than I did for JD. Mm-hmm. The economy has certainly changed significantly since you first penned The Truly Disadvantaged. And what, from your perspective, what effects have those changes had on social organization and social organization and poverty?
Well, I don't know if the conditions have changed that much since I wrote The Truly Disadvantaged. The one big difference is that I think there's the increasing technology and automation has created problems for a lot of low-skilled workers. I mentioned automation replacing jobs that cashiers held and parking lot attendants held. So you have a combination not only of the relocation of industries overseas that I talked about in A Truly Disadvantaged, but now you have increasing automation and technology replacing jobs. And this worries me because I think that people who have poor education are going to be in difficult situations increasingly down the road. And you look at inner city schools, not only schools in inner cities, but in many other neighborhoods, and kids are not being properly educated. And so they're not being prepared for the changes that are occurring in the economy. I remember one social scientist saying that it's as if, talking about the black population, it's as if racism and racial discrimination put black people in their place, stepped aside to watch increasing technology and automation destroy that place. So I think that, so the one significant difference from the time I wrote The Truly Disadvantaged in 1987 is the growing problems created by increasing technology for the poor.
Bill, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Because this is something I was, you know, looking through your book on my Kindle earlier today, and I kept on coming back to this question. I'm curious what you think, which is, if the civil rights movement had happened in the early 20th century as opposed to the mid-20th century, do you think that black Americans would be more caught up than they are right now? In other words, do you think that it happened, that the civil rights advancements happened at a time when technology was just really starting to hammer the economies that they relied on? And if it happened in an area where there weren't quite the same premiums on human capital, that maybe they could have caught up a little bit better than they have over the past 50 years.
So what you're saying is that if civil rights movement had happened at this time.
The early 20th century.
Oh, the early 20th century.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
So if it had happened when we were just transitioning from the proverbial farm to the factory, do you think it would have had a significant difference?
Not sure.
Right.
What do you think?
Say. Huh? Well, I do, you know, reading The Truly Disadvantaged today, I was thinking maybe the answer is yes, because part of what happened with the civil rights movement is that the economy was rapidly changing just as some of these legal strictures were you know, as black Americans were freed from some of these legal strictures. And I do wonder if the economy it was in some ways, as these legal changes were happening in a very positive way, the economy hit Black Americans super hard. And I wonder if those legal strictures would have fallen at a time when the economy wasn't changing so rapidly, maybe things would be a little bit different today.
This reminds me of the point that Bayard Rustin raised in the early 1960s. He said, you know, it's great to outlaw discrimination and prejudice, but it's also important to recognize that if you have a referee in the ring and you say there will be no discrimination, but one fighter has had all of the training and the other fighter has not,
yep,
which fighter is going to come out ahead? And so he says much more emphasis has now got to be placed on dealing with these basic economic problems. And he told Martin Luther King Jr., he said, look, he says, what good is it to be allowed to eat in a restaurant if you can't afford a hamburger? So we're going to have to address some of these fundamental economic problems,
sure,
that are devastating the community. So that reinforces the point you made.
That is a perfect segue to a set of questions that I want to ask you both. It's about the question of race in America. We know that racism and discrimination have a long history in the U.S. and that the effects of that history are still experienced by individuals on a daily basis today. When those experiences are aggregated, we can see large mobility, wealth, and income gaps between white Americans and African Americans. We are also hearing and reading and seeing about the culture of despair, the opioid epidemic, and the disability culture in rural and Rust Belt America. So I'm going to ask a sensitive question. Are there differences between being Black, jobless, and poor, and being white, jobless, and poor? And if so, what are they and why? Bill, I'm going to give you the honor of tackling that first.
You know, that's a very interesting question because I was just, J.D., you wrote in your book about the problems of poor whites. And it seems that poor whites right now are more pessimistic than any group. And the question, is why? I was sort of impressed with your analysis of the white working class in the age of Trump. You pointed out that when Barack Obama became president, there were a lot of people in your community who are really struggling and who believe that the modern American meritocracy did not seem to apply to them. And these people were not doing well. And then you have this Black president who's a successful product of American meritocracy, who has raised the hope of African Americans. And he represented every positive thing that these working class folks that you were right about did not possess or lacked. And Trump emerged as a candidate who sort of spoke to these people. You know, what is interesting is that if you look at the Pew Research polls, recent Pew Research polls, I think you pointed this out in your book, the working class whites right now are more pessimistic than any other group about their economic future and their children's future. Now, is that pessimism justified? I think they're overly pessimistic. I still maintain that to be Black, poor and jobless is worse than being white, poor, and jobless. Okay? But for some reason, the white poor is more pessimistic. Now, I think with respect to the black poor and working class, there's a kind of an Obama effect here, you know. I think that may wear off, and then blacks will become even more or equally as pessimistic as whites in a few years. But, yeah.
Yeah, I'd really like for Pew to run those numbers right now and see if the rates of pessimism among working class blacks are changed or inverted relative to where they were a couple of years ago. You know, people ask me what I see as the similarities between working class blacks and working class whites and what the differences are. And whenever they ask me what the differences are, I always say, talk to Bill Wilson. He's a lot smarter about this stuff than I am. But the thing that jumps out to me most when I think about the differences is that housing policy, especially housing policy back in the 50s and 60s, affects modern day black Americans much more than it does modern day white Americans, especially the working and non-working poor. What I mean by that is that I think that, you know, for partially because of research that Bill has done and partially for research that a lot of other folks have done, you know, concentrated poverty is really bad. It's worse than just being poor, to be sort of socially isolated in these islands of only other poor people. And I think that's a much more common experience among black Americans because of the residual effects of housing policy in the 50s and 60s. So I think that, to me, if I was going to pick one single factor that was driving the continued difference, I would probably say housing policy. This sort of question of kind of, you know, is it better or worse to be working class or sort of poor, jobless, and white versus poor, jobless, and black? I mean, I think, you know, all things being equal, certainly poor, jobless, and black is sort of worse off. If you look at wealth numbers, if you look at income numbers, that's still the case. I do worry a little bit that we don't have the vocabulary to really talk about the full measure of disadvantage in the country right now. What I mean by that is that we're pretty comfortable talking about class, we're pretty comfortable talking about gender, we're reasonably comfortable talking about race. When you talk about things like single-parent families, family trauma, concentrated poverty, all of these things that, you know, go into what I would call the disadvantage bucket or the privilege bucket, it's not those three factors. It's probably, you know, two dozen or three dozen factors. We're really bad about talking about everything except for race, class, and gender. And I think that's one way that the conversation has really broken down, especially in the past few years.
Great, thank you.
So this reminds me of your points, J.D., remind me of a paper that Robert Sampson, colleague at Harvard, and I wrote in 1995, entitled Toward a Theory of Race, Crime, and Urban Inequality, a paper that has become a classic, actually, in the field of criminology because it has generated dozens of research studies. And our basic thesis, we were addressing, you know, race and violent crime, is that racial disparities and violent crime are attributable in large part to the persistent structural disadvantages that are disproportionately concentrated in African American urban communities. But we argue that the ultimate cause of crime were similar for both whites and blacks. And we pose a central question. In American cities, is it possible to reproduce in white communities the structural circumstances under which many blacks live? And, you know, that whites haven't fully experienced the structural reality that blacks have experienced does not negate the power of our theory, because we argue had whites been exposed to the same structural conditions as blacks, then white communities would behave the crime rate would be in the predicted direction. And then we had an epiphany. What about the rural white communities that you talk about, where you're not only talking about joblessness, you're not only talking about poverty, but you're also talking about family structure. So here in Appalachia, you could reproduce some of the conditions that exist in inner city neighborhoods. And therefore, it would be good to test our theory in these areas, because we'd be looking at the family structure, the rates of single parent families. We'd be looking at joblessness. We'd be looking at poverty. So we need to move beyond the urban areas and see if we can look at communities that come close to approximating, or maybe are even worse in some cases than some in inner city neighborhoods. And this reminds me that I was reading an interview, excellent interview. Remember I wrote to you that first time I read this interview? It was before I even read Hillbilly Elegy. And I went and read the book after reading this interview. Or maybe it was in Hillbilly Elegy where you referred to the research of the economist Raj Chetty, and who did some path-breaking research on concentrated poverty, single-parent families, and mobility.
Yep.
And the reports in the newspapers focused on concentrated poverty and then talk about rates of single-parent families, which he also emphasized,
yep.
You see. But if you want to capture both, it might be good to focus on rural areas like the ones you wrote about.
Sure.
And see if some of the same factors are reproduced that I write about in The Truly Disadvantaged.
So there's a second book for you. my colleague Richard Reeves has recently published a piece that demonstrated that there's a century economic mobility gap between black and white men. So in a sense, historically lower rates of upward mobility have delayed the economic ascent of black men by a century. Should we be concerned?
Could you repeat that?
Yeah. The historically lower rates of upward mobility have delayed the economic ascent of black men by a century compared to white men. So the question is, should we be concerned? And do we need differentiated sets of policies to address black economic mobility and, on the other hand, white economic mobility? So, J.D., I'm going to give that to you first.
You should have sent these questions to us ahead of time.
No.
So we could have thought.
That's the fun. Yeah, no fun in that.
Well, I think you asked two questions. The first was, should we be concerned? My answer to that is yes, and I'll let Bill take the second question. this question of should we have differentiated policies, I think it depends on what we mean by differentiated, right? So to take Bill's, something he said earlier, this question of technological change and the way that it's impacting these communities, I think that requires us to fundamentally rethink the way that we approach higher education, right? And that's one of been my persistent frustration thinking about policy for the past couple of years, is that we have this rapidly changing economy. We haven't changed our institutions or even our institutional thinking to match up to that rapidly changing economy. But if you're focused on sort of correcting those gaps, or if you're just basically focused on giving help to the people who need it, then you're going to have a differentiated application of help because black Americans need it, you know, maybe on average more than white Americans. If we talk about sort of the negative effects, for example, of concentrated poverty, this is something that I really worry about. And back to, you know, Raj Chetty, a different paper that he published showed that there are these really interesting positive effects of the moving to opportunity study, right? But my guess is that concentrated poverty equally hurts black and white Americans. It's just that black Americans experience it more. So there's going to be a differentiated effect if you try to rectify that problem but not because you say we're going to try to help black people more than white people, just because you're going to say I want to help the problem of concentrated poverty, and because they're suffering from it more, that's going to have, you know, that effect will at least be differentiated. But I don't know. I haven't thought about sort of whether you should go into it sort of before the fact and try to apply these things differently. My guess is that that's probably politically not a great idea and may not be necessary from a moral perspective either, but I'm curious what Bill thinks.
No, I agree. Certainly in this day and age, it's not a good idea. But if you ask me, what am I most concerned about right now with in addressing problems of poverty and so on? I'm concerned about jobs. And although I wouldn't phrase it this way, I wouldn't say that we need public sector jobs for black males. I would say we need public sector jobs where people live in concentrated poverty, and that would apply to white males, not only males but females as well as blacks. But which group would benefit disproportionately from a public sector's jobs program? It would be black males, because black males have these high prison records. And therefore, because of their prison records, many of them find it extremely difficult, because of the incarceration rates, many of them find it extremely difficult to find jobs in the private sector. And therefore, at least for the temporary, at least as opposed to a permanent solution, I would like to see public sector job creation for those who have difficulty finding employment in the private sector. And when I speak of public sector jobs, I mean the type of jobs provided by the WPA during the Great Depression, jobs that would improve the infrastructure in our communities, including the underfunded National Park Service, state and local park districts. I just feel that public sector jobs are very, very important, particularly for black adults who've been stigmatized by prison records and who thus find it virtually impossible to find jobs in the private sector. Now, saying that, I'm under no illusion that these programs, that a program like public sector jobs program would garner widespread support in the current political climate. But I feel that we have to start thinking seriously about what should be done when we have a more favorable political climate and when people from both parties are willing to consider seriously policies that could make a difference.
So we have time for one more question, and I'm going to start, J.D., with you. So in a paper by Richard Reeves and another colleague of mine, Eleanor Krauss, that was released today, the evidence is that rural areas with the best rates of upward mobility are the ones with the highest rates of out-migration, especially among young people. Should we just accept that some communities are essentially dying and focus our efforts on helping people move on to other places with more opportunity? Or should we be trying to turn around these blighted areas?
that is a really tough one. So I'm going to try to judiciously split the baby here, and I'll probably fail. But when I think about should we try to fix these blighted areas, I think that it depends on how we define area, right? Because my concern with some of these out-migration arguments is that we say if you can't find a good job in West Virginia, you should move to San Francisco, California. And there are two concerns with that. The first is that try to convince somebody that they can afford a place in San Francisco, California, when it's a two-bedroom apartment costs you $4,500 a month. So I think that, again, going back to housing policy, that really makes this out-migration pretty difficult. The second thing is that you really do... I think we have to understand there's a difference between out-migration from, let's say, eastern Kentucky to southwestern Ohio versus eastern Kentucky to San Diego, California, because the former allows you to preserve some important social contacts and social connections. It is cheaper to move there. It's less culturally intimidating to move there. I mean, I cannot imagine what my grandparents would have said if you had told them in the 1940s that they had to move to modern-day San Francisco. It really would have been, you need to move to an entirely different country, maybe an entirely different planet. And I think that that's important. So the way that I think about this problem is that we have to accept that while out-migration has to be a part of the solution, we can't just say every single person in Breathitt County, Kentucky has to leave and Breathitt County, Kentucky gets to close up shop. But if we can regionally develop big cities like Lexington, like Pittsburgh, like Columbus, Ohio, that obviously has downstream effects, and that allows you to have out-migration to places that isn't so culturally foreign and enables people to maintain those social connections even as they move to areas with higher employment and, oh, by the way, still play a positive role in the communities back home. I think that's the way that I approach that particular problem.
Great. Thank you.
You know, my colleague at Harvard, Robert Sampson, and former student Patrick Sharkey, who's at NYU, have argued for durable investments in disadvantaged neighborhoods to counter the persistent disinvestments in such neighborhoods. And I was wondering if you use that argument and focus on Appalachia, for example, what would investments look like? And I'm going to put this question to you, J.D. If you're talking about investments in these communities, would they include such things as hospitals, clinics, road construction, shopping centers, daycare centers, these kinds of things? Would that be helpful? Would those things be helpful?
Yes. So I think it would definitely be helpful. One of the concerns I have with what we've seen with regional economic development is that it very often happens through the avenue of, let me provide you tax credits so that you can open up new retail, right? I don't think that's especially durable economic development, right? I mean, I think that we have to think of local economies as a sort of pyramid. You need real industries, manufacturing, then you have retail on top of it. But you can't really rebuild some of these economic centers with just retail. There is actually an interesting bill that's moving through Congress right now that would in some ways place long-term capital investment at parity with short-term capital investment, like tax credits. Mm-hmm. That would allow things like venture capital investment and much bigger, longer-term patient capital to invest in some of these areas and create, you know, more durable jobs and more durable sectors. But I also think, and my thinking honestly has probably changed in this in the past few years, though maybe change isn't the right word, it's just I've started to think about this a little bit more seriously. When I look at, you know, some of the work that David Autor has done about the China shock and the way that it's impacted some of these areas, I do think that we've been so caught up in thinking about long-term well-being as purely a function of consumption that we haven't thought about the fact that if you pay 3 cents less for a widget at Walmart, but half of your community just lost its job, that's, you know, your purchasing power is slightly greater, but your community has lost something really significant. I think that's been missing from our conversations about economics and jobs, especially on the right. But I really think across the spectrum, we focus too little on bringing good, durable, high-paying work into some of these areas. And consequently, if you look at just a policy across the board, we've congratulated ourselves because purchasing power, even among the low income, has gone up, not recognizing that purchasing power that comes from a government transfer is a lot different from purchasing power that comes from a good job.
Thank you both very much. We are now going to take questions from the audience. So, Belle Sawhill from Brookings. So, I'd like everybody to be able to say who they are and the organization they're coming from and then ask our question, please. Thank you. And I'll take a couple of these. I'll take yours first and then we'll take a few more.
Okay. Mm-hmm. First thing I want to do is to thank both of you for such a thoughtful conversation. I mean, Camille ask you really tough, provocative questions. And so it was a great conversation. I think I want to add to the provocative questions list here. We haven't talked much about our politics going forward and how they may play out in terms of things that you both might be in favor of. I mean, Bill, you say you're for a public jobs program, but obviously that's politically going to be extremely difficult to convince much of the public, including many of the so-called white working class that J.D. has been studying. They don't like government programs. They don't like handouts. They want, I think, as I read it, the literature, including your book, they want real jobs, not government jobs. In fact, they really dislike a lot that they see in first-line government workers. With that as background and thinking about, you know, where does our politics go from here, I happen to have read this weekend a new small essay by Mark Lilla, who is arguing quite controversially that the Democratic Party needs to put less emphasis on identity politics. That means staying away, presumably, from racial divides and culture and all of that. Do you have any thoughts about generally how we bring the country back together again politically, and specifically this notion that maybe the Democratic Party is losing the white working class by putting too much emphasis on immigrants, minorities, women, et cetera.
So,
sorry.
I'll let you guys, I'll let you, Gabby, I'll let you gather your thoughts there.
I'll take a shot and then
see. A brave man.
Hope that there's vodka in this.
So, you know, I blurbed Mark Lilla's book.
Did you? Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. Oh, that's right.
I blurbed it. It's a very, it's a, what's the title of the book?
Once and a Future Liberal.
Huh?
That's right.
The Once and a Future Liberal. Yeah, I blurbed the book. And, you know, Mark Lilla and a number of other post-election analysts observed that, as you point out, Bill, that the Democrats should not make the same mistake that they made in the last election, namely in attempts to mobilize people of color, women, immigrants, and the LGBT community with identity politics. They tended to ignore the problems of poor white Americans. I was watching the Democratic convention with my wife on a ship, on a cruise to Alaska. And one concern I had was that there did not seem to be any representatives on the stage representing poor white America. And I could just see, you know, some of these poor whites saying, "They don't care about us, you know. They got all these blacks. They got immigrants. They got, but you don't have any of us on the stage." Maybe I'm overstating the point, but I was concerned about that. Now, one notable exception, critics like Mark Lilla point out, was Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders had a progressive and unifying populist economic message in the Democratic primaries, a message that resonated with a significant segment of the white lower class population, lower class working class populations. However, Sanders was not the Democratic nominee, and Donald Trump was able to, as we all know, capture notable support from these populations with a divisive, not unifying, populist message. I agree with Mark Lilla that we don't want to make the same mistake again. We've got to reach out to all groups. We've got to start to focus on coalition politics. We have to develop a sense of interdependence where groups come to recognize that they can't accomplish goals without the support of other groups. We have to frame issues differently. We can't go the same route. We can't give up on the white working class.
Okay. J.D., did you want to tackle that, or
shall
we look for other questions?
I can briefly answer. I mean, as a Republican who's deeply worried about the American right, this gives me a great chance to riff on the other side. So just a couple of thoughts as you asked the question and as Bill was responding. The first is that on this question of identity politics, I think that what worries me is that it's not a recognition that there are disadvantaged non-white groups that need some help or there needs to be some closing of the gap. You know, when I talk to folks back home, very conservative people, they're actually pretty open-minded if you talk about the problems that exist in the black ghetto because of problems of concentrated poverty and the fact that the black ghetto was in some ways created by housing policy. It was the choice of black Americans that it was in some ways created by housing policy. I find actually a lot of openness when I talk to friends and family about that. What I find no openness about is when somebody who they don't know and who they think judges them points at them and says, you need to apologize for your white privilege. And so I think that in some ways, making these questions of disadvantage zero sum is really toxic. And I think that's one way that the Democrats really lost the white working class in the 2016 election. The second piece that occurs to me, and this applies across the political spectrum, is that what we're trying to do in the United States, it's very easy to be cynical about American politics, but we're trying to build a multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-religious nation, not just an agglomeration, but an actual nation of people from all of these different tribes and unify them around a common creed. I think that's really delicate. It's basically never been done successfully over a long period in human history, and I think it requires a certain amount of rhetorical finesse that we don't see from many of our politicians on either side these days, and that really, really worries me.
Great. Thank you both. I'm going to take three other questions, and then we can answer them. So this gentleman here, young lady here with her hand up. And then I'll take, person right in the back there. Okay, so we'll get on this side first.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I've known Bill Wilson for years. I've known J.D. over the telephone.
I thought that was you.
I chase you all over town.
A fellow Middletonian?
Yes, I tried to catch you at the book fair on Saturday. The line, for those of you who weren't there, stretched all the way out of the D.C. Convention Center and down Massachusetts Avenue. I never saw anything like it since the Beatles came to town. But anyway... yes, I'm a fellow MIDI, and from class of 65, so I went there before you were born. We just had our 50th anniversary reunion here a couple of years ago. I'm delighted by your book. Folks have asked me if I ever thought about writing a memoir. I said my life was too dull, my town was too quiet. When I grew up, we were an all-American city. You may have read that in your history books. Sure. Back in the 50s. We were one of the all-American cities in America. A few years ago, Forbes chose Middletown as one of the 10 fastest dying cities in America. This tells you what's happened over time. So I have a lot of things I'd love to inject. I'm just going to ask one question. As you know, I've talked before about when I came out of Middletown High in 65, I was able to work at the steel mill at Armco. And make enough money to pay my tuition at Ohio University, go Bobcats. For tuition in 1965 at Ohio U was $770. With room and board, $1,240. It wasn't hard for me, the son of a mother who was a cook and a father who was a factory worker, to move up to the middle class, thanks to Ohio's excellent higher education system. Years later, of course, you went to the Marines to get a scholarship to go to Ohio State.
Sure.
And so it was possible, but it certainly is tougher now to go from working class Middletown. Well, we don't have the steel mill jobs in the summer anymore. the five paper mills that we used to have all gone. All the industries up and down I-75 all the way to Detroit, General Motors, Frigidaire, GM, Delco, Battery, Huffy, Bicycle, National Cash Register, go on and on and on. What Bill Wilson writes about in the, you know, the gone overseas or other types of changes that have gone on. We were talking about automation back in the 50s. And the 60s. And, of course, we see what has happened, and it's still happening. But my question, though, really, is we haven't talked much about those front row kids like yourself there who had a chance to go to college and found a way there. That route has gotten tougher. Do you think we need to do something to make it easier to get higher education, some schooling beyond high school?
Okay, great. Thank you. And this... the woman here with the red sweater, please. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, gentlemen. Extremely challenging.
Can you announce you say your name, please?
I will say my name. It's Mindy Reiser, and I have worked and continue to with a number of NGOs across the world concerned with social justice. My question is about a segment of the American population you haven't talked about, and that is the aging baby boomers who come in all colors, shapes, and sizes. Some of these folks will have Social Security, which isn't very much. Some will not at all. We've talked about the challenges of jobs. What is going to happen to these people, some of whom will not get jobs and will rely on diminishing Social Security, and that is not exactly assured anymore either. So I'd like you to address that part of the population whose future does not look all that bright.
Great, thank you. And then we have one way in the back there. She has her hand up. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Chen Liu, and I'm a correspondent from China's Xinhua News Agency. Actually, I have two questions for JD. One is that you mentioned about culture, which could be the third important element apart from the personal and structural agencies to have those poverties. So I just want you to maybe categorize or say more about this culture, so what it could include. Because when I just read about your book, first I thought it may be something related to the history of American, like those people who used to work in the hill, the mountain, or the farmers. But it turns out maybe there are something more or different from that. So can you just say more about it? And the second question is about the globalization. I think both of the speakers just mentioned that the process of globalization just contribute a lot to the poverty or just make it a faster pace for those working class in America, no matter white or white or black, to become an obvious problem. So do you think what could be the solution for this? Or is it really necessary, just like President Trump said, that anti-globalization could be one of the solutions or necessary one? Thank you.
Thank you. So we have a question on ways to make it easier to get a higher education. What about job opportunities for aging baby boomers? And then a special set just for you, where you can, you know, if you would like to maybe go in a little more about what you meant by culture.
Sure.
And then for both of you, if you want to discuss globalization and its effect on poverty in the U.S.
Well, I just to answer your question very quickly. Forget the political climate, but I'd like to see us increase the Pell Grants to make it possible for folks who don't have much income. Increase the Pell Grants.
Okay, great. JD, do you want to?
Yeah. So
any of these?
So my general worry with the college education, so writ large, is sort of two things. So the first is that I think we've constructed a society effectively in which a college education is now the only pathway to the middle class, and I think that's a real failure on our part. It's not something you see in every country, and I don't think it necessarily has to be the case here. There are other ways to get post-secondary education, and I absolutely think that we have to make that easier. And I really see this as sort of the defining policy challenge of the next 10 years, is to create more of those pathways. Because the second point on this is that college is a really, really culturally terrifying place for a lot of working class people. Now we can try to make it less culturally terrifying. We can try to make sort of the elites of our universities a little bit more welcoming to folks like me. And this is something that I wrote about in the book, really feeling like a true outsider at Yale for the first time in an educational institution. I think that we also have to acknowledge that part of the reason that people feel like cultural outsiders is that is for reasons that aren't necessarily going to be easy to fix. And if we don't create more pathways for these folks, we shouldn't be surprised that a lot of them aren't going to take the one pathway that's there that effectively runs through a culturally alien institution.
Thank you. Other questions?
A couple others. On the baby boomer question, I'll try to be very, very quick, but I don't necessarily have a fantastic answer to this, but let me add one thought that I had while you were asking that question, which is that in certain areas, especially in Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia, and so forth, I think the biggest underreported problem for the baby boomers is the fact that they are taking care of children that they didn't necessarily anticipate taking care of because of the opioid crisis. This is the biggest driver of elder poverty in the state of Ohio, is that you have entire families that have been transplanted from one generation to the next. They were planning for retirement based on one Social Security income, and now all of a sudden they have two, three additional mouths to feed. I think my concern for the baby boom generation is especially those folks, of course, because it's not just bad for them, it's bad for these children who are all of a sudden thrown in poverty because of the opioid addiction of that middle generation, of the parents, of the kids, and the sons and daughters of the grandkids. And then the very last question, sort of culture, I think of as a way to understand the sum of the environmental impacts that you can't necessarily define as structural, right? So the effects of family instability and trauma that exist in people, the effects of social capital and social networks in people's lives, all of these things, I think, add up to a broad set of variables that can either promote upward mobility or inhibit upward mobility. And again, I think we very often talk about job opportunities and educational opportunities. We very often talk about individual responsibility and personal agency. We very rarely, I think, talk about those middle layers and those institutional factors that, in a lot of ways, are the real drivers of this problem.
Okay. I just want to add just one point. I think that this is too radical to seriously consider right now, but at some point, I think we're going to have to think about it. And that is to give cash assistance or reduce the tax rate for those who are experiencing compounded deprivation. At some point, we're going to be faced with a problem. We have to rescue people. Some economists are talking about the negative income tax and so on, but something that we're going to have to be thinking about.
Great, thank you. I'm going to take three more. This gentleman here, this young lady here, and again, Ignacio.
Henry Aaron Brookings. My question is for J.D. Vance. I've heard in your comments what strike me as a genuine and heartfelt sympathy for the economic and social circumstances, not only of poor whites in Appalachia, but also for the concentrated poverty in urban areas, that you have a genuine sympathy for both. You also stated that you come to this concern as a conservative and as a Republican. Now, in looking at the current political environment, which is, I think, where we need to start rather than our aspirations for a different environment we would really like in the future. Starting from the current economic environment, I note that we've spent all of 2017 on a political debate, which now seems, from my standpoint, mercifully to coming to an end, about doing away with the Affordable Care Act. We are about to have a month-long high-stakes debate about the child health insurance program, which President Trump's budget proposes significantly to cut. We are confronting the possibility of a major fight over the national debt cap, which at least some elements in Congress would like to use to as a pressure tool to reduce the size and scope of the federal government. We are debating whether to reform entitlement programs, and notably disability insurance, which, if one looks at a map of where disability benefits are most received, looks like the map for your book, actually. Kentucky, Arkansas, Alabama, Mississippi, Ohio, Pennsylvania. My question is, as a conservative Republican, how do you reconcile the concern you've expressed with the apparent agenda from those with whom you identify politically?
Okay, so we're going to take two more questions in this round.
Thank God.
This lady right here, and then Ignacio.
Hello, my name is Samira Rabar Daniels. I actually married into an Appalachian family myself, so I've had a close look at the situation myself. And I'm wondering if you had to sort of envision of a, not a political leader, but more philosophical, substantive role model. What qualities, aside from the typical, like, you know, honesty and so forth, I mean, what would be the sort of gestalt of that leader that would perhaps, you know, mobilize? I mean, that can happen, but because of the technological age, we don't have that sort of, you know, more Renaissance-minded philosophical temperament is not sort of percolating. And I'm wondering if you had to envision it, what would be the role model, and similarly for you, what do you see, what would be the gestalt of that leader?
Okay, thank you. Ignacio.
Hello, well, thank you, the three of you, for the discussion. It was very fascinating.
Can you say your name?
My name is Ignacio Peso. Well, my question actually starts with an article I read in the New York Times a few days ago, or it was maybe 2 days ago. It's about like the role of private firms also. It was a comparison between like the job conditions years ago with a lady from Kodak who was able to rise and get a job and get a part-time job, like get an education, and then at the end, like in the same private firm, rising to a higher position, and right now a janitor in Apple, right? And I think in this conversation we talk a lot about like the power of stories and how they can convey mobilities and talk about like more structural aspects. I was wondering, what is your opinion about like how what's the role of private firms in this discussion, and what sort of policies can you envision regarding that? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So we have a question about reconciling your concerns with concentrated poverty with the sort of agenda of the GOP, a question around what do role models who are sort of embodying, a way out, sort of, and when we think about the poverty debate, what do those people look like? And then what's the role of private firms in economic mobility for poor and low-income Americans?
Could you repeat the second question?
What does a leader look like who could possibly lead us towards a set of solutions when we think about poverty in the U.S.?
So I guess sort of I'll start, because the question about, I think, the GOP is directed specifically at me. You know, so the first thing that I'll say about that is that I agree with many of the conservative critiques that are levied as sort of against some Democratic policy. I very rarely, at least if we're defining Republican policy as sort of what comes out of Congress, I very rarely agree with Republican Congress about how to answer those critiques. So the way that I broadly look at this philosophically is that there is a distinction, an important one, between libertarianism and conservatism. So sort of partially we'll try to answer your question about outsourcing. I think that, for example, on this question of labor unions, I think the sort of classic libertarian answer to this question, which has really dominated on the right for the past 30 years, is that effectively, for a whole host of reasons, labor unions are anti-competitive, they're bad for non-members, and they're bad for actual firms. Consequently, they're sort of, for cartel reasons, they're sort of bad from a public policy perspective. I think a better conservative answer to the fact that we've gone from 35% private labor participation to 6% private labor participation is to recognize that labor unions can be economically destructive, to recognize that labor unions, as Burke would say, could also be incredibly important social institutions that play a positive role in communities. And so the question isn't how do we destroy labor unions, but it's how do we reform labor unions so they actually work in the 21st century. And I think that that would answer partially your question about outsourcing. It's a really fascinating journal or article by Orrin Cass at the Manhattan Institute, a conservative think tank, about how we might reform labor unions so that they actually accomplish something economically important, so that they can rebuild themselves and increase private participation. And I think that's a conservative idea. Has it come from a Republican Congress? No, it has not. Have I been a constant critic of Republican domestic policy for the past 5 years because I think we're not thinking about these issues? Absolutely. The flip side of it is that I think that much of what I see on the left is, or at least sometimes thinks that these cultural problems that I write about and care about are invisible and don't actually exist. Now, does that mean that sort of very thoughtful left-of-center think tank fellows don't care about these problems? Does that mean that Bill Wilson doesn't think about these problems? No, but I certainly think that the Democratic Party in some ways thinks that these questions of culture and long-term multi-generational environmental effects are sort of invisible to a lot of their policymaking. So I agree with the conservative critique there, and I think that conservatives have to offer some alternative vision, which we have failed to do for not just the past 5 years, but maybe for a little bit longer than that. So, you know, my view of my role in this ecosystem is to try to take us from criticizing a lot of what's been done in the past that's wrong, and a lot of those criticisms I agree with, to actually doing something that's different. But I do think the last point I'll make about this, the fundamental hill that we have to get over, the fundamental problem that conservatives have to accept, is that sometime you have to spend money to solve social problems. Not always. Does that mean that government is always the answer? Certainly it doesn't. But I think the sort of baseline constant refusal to accept that sometimes you have to spend money is at the core of our real problem. And if we can get past that, I actually think there might be some good ideas coming out of the right, and hopefully I can be a part of that.
So let me address the question about the ideal leader, the leader who should move us forward. For me, a role model would be one who would use the bully pulpit to reinforce and promote the principle of equality of life chances. Now, this is the philosopher James Fiskin coined the notion principle of equality of life chances. And according to this principle, if we can predict with a high degree of accuracy where individuals end up in the competition for preferred positions merely by knowing their race, class, gender, and family background, then the conditions under which their motivations and talents have developed must be utterly unfair. Supporters of this principle believe that a person should not be able to enter a hospital ward of healthy newborn babies and predict with considerable accuracy where they will end up in life simply by knowing their race, class, gender, family background, or the ecological areas where their parents reside. To repeat, for me, a role, ideal role model would be one who would use the bully pulpit to reinforce and promote the principle of equality of life chances.
Great. Thank you both. We're going to take a few more questions. The gentleman in the back, gentleman with the glasses, and next to him, the gentleman with the orange shirt.
Kwesi Rollins with the Institute for Educational Leadership here in Washington, D.C. You've addressed this tangentially, but I wonder, it seems that this may be overly simplistic, but the flip side of extreme poverty seems to be the extreme concentration of wealth, not only in this country, but obviously across the world. And I wonder if we can address any of the problems that you guys have talked about without directly addressing the concentration of wealth and the fact that many corporations and super rich in this country are not paying their fair share of taxes, in my view.
So we have the gentleman in the glasses and the suit here next to the gentleman with the orange T-shirt.
Hi, Richard Collenberg with the Century Foundation. You both have talked about the effects of concentrated poverty, and I'm wondering what you would advocate in terms of public policy. And I'll throw out one idea that Bill and I have talked about a little bit. In 1968, 50 years ago, we saw the passage of the Fair Housing Act. And since then, racial segregation has declined from a dissimilarity index of 79 to 59. So 100 would be pure segregation. Zero would be perfectly integrated. Meanwhile, we've seen an increase in economic segregation. And I'm wondering what you all would think about an economic Fair Housing Act that would go after the issue of concentrated poverty by addressing the discrimination that goes on in terms of exclusionary zoning, where certain neighborhoods are basically off limits for working class people because apartment buildings or townhouses aren't allowed to be built there.
Great, thank you.
Mike Golash, Amalgamated Transit Union. Mr. Vance, you've put forward several different roads out of poverty, better education, cultural change, job training, college, cheaper colleges, I guess. But the problem is, I see that does not create jobs. That just creates competition for jobs. So at the end of the day, even if everyone's well educated, wouldn't there still be a lot of poverty?
Okay. So we have a question on the concentration of wealth in the U.S., a question about an economic fair housing kind of policy to address concentrated poverty, and then finally, whether the policy prescriptions around creating a better and more educated, more skilled and educated workforce actually addresses the true cause of poverty.
Let me just say that regarding the addressing the problem of concentration of wealth and inequality, that is a major problem that we have to confront. So all I would say, yes, we have to deal with that problem. That has to be high on our agenda, on the public agenda. That's all I want to say about that. Because we could go on and on talking about that. Addressing the question of increase in economic segregation, people don't realize that racial segregation is on the decline, while economic segregation, as a segregation of families by income, is on the increase. And so, yes, I would support your proposal of dealing with exclusionary zoning and so on. Say a little bit more about that. I mean, you just published an op-ed piece on that. So,
uh, Well, the basic notion is that, you know, here we had some success through a legal policy, the Fair Housing Act, where we've seen this decline in racial segregation. And yet what replaced kind of the old racial zoning from the 1920s has been economic zoning. And so it seems to me that just as it should be shameful to exclude people from entire neighborhoods based on race, it ought to be as concerning to us in our culture and in our policy to have laws that, in essence, are excluding people based on class. In Montgomery County, Maryland, where I live, there is an alternative to that policy. It's called inclusionary zoning, where the notion was that if people are good enough to, you know, take care of residents' kids, if they're able to teach the children, if they're able to take care of the lawns, they ought to be good enough to live in these communities as well.
Right. That's why I wanted to give you the floor, Rick. Your message is important. Great.
Thank you very much. So, J.D., did you want to address any of these questions around concentrated poverty, the Economic Fair Housing kind of act?
Sure.
Creating a better skilled and, you know, more educated workforce, but whether or not that addresses the true cause of poverty in the U.S.?
Yeah, so on the inequality and concentration of wealth at the top thing, I'll say this is one area where I actually think conservative Senator Mike Lee from Utah has had some really, really interesting ideas. One of the tax reform proposals Senator Lee has advocated for is actually setting the capital taxation rate at the same rate as the ordinary income rate, because that's what's really driving this difference, right? It's not ordinary income earners. It's not salaried professionals, though, as Richard Reeves says, that's a problem. It's primarily actually that folks in the global economy, especially the ultra elite folks in the global economy, have achieved some sort of economic liftoff from the rest of the country. And I think that in light of that, it doesn't make a ton of sense that we continue to have the taxation policy that we do. And frankly, that's one of the reasons why I am sort of so conflicted about President Trump, because I think in some ways, instinctively at least, the president recognizes this, though we'll see what actually happens with tax reform over the next few months. The question about job competition is absolutely correct, that you can't just have a better educated workforce but hold the number of workers constant. At the same time, I do think there's a bit of a chicken and egg problem here, right? Because you know, while the skills gap is overplayed and while it violates all of these rules of Econ 101, one of the things you hear pretty consistently from folks who would like to expand, would like to hire more, would like to produce more, is that there are real labor force constraints, especially in what might be called non-cognitive skills, right? I mean, this is a thing that you hear a lot in my home state, that if you really want to hire more, you really want to produce more and sell more, but the problem is the opioid epidemic has effectively thinned the pool of people who are even able to work. So I do think that productivity is really important, but I also think that we tend to think of these things in two mathematical and sort of hyper-rational ways, that part of the reason productivity is held back is because we have real problems in the labor market, and if you fix one, you could help other, and that may create a virtuous cycle.
Thank you both. We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank our administrative communications facilities and security professionals for all the incredible work that they've done to make this event a success. I wanted to let you know that copies of Dream Hoarders by Richard Reeves and Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. are on sale outside. Please join me in thanking Bill Wilson and J.D. Vance for sharing their time and thoughts today.